Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 695, Dancing Machine, Thoughts on the Life and Death of Michael Jackson. This program, the second half of this program, is being recorded on November 1st of the year 2009. Now, many people may be wondering why in the name of Bleep, Dave is talking about Michael Jackson. It's a good question. Not somebody I cared about in life. However, he was a source of considerable attention, but what's more important, he was the source of considerable expenditure of money. And when you have considerable expenditure of money, that is always a political consideration. So that is why we're talking about Michael Jackson. Now, in side one of the program, we took a look at some of the people who were around Michael Jackson and some of the interests that were around Michael Jackson. They run the gamut from veteran intelligence officer Gordon Novell, whose name crops up in connection with the investigations into the assassination of John F. Kennedy. It crops up in connection with the Watergate investigation and many others. The Nation of Islam were very much present around Michael Jackson during the closing phase of his life, headed up by Louis Farrakhan, who himself has been the focal point of considerable investigation in connection with the assassination of Malcolm X, the man whose mantle he has assumed. For some background on Louis X, as Farrakhan was calling himself then, and the assassination of Malcolm X, For the Record program number 21. There was also a mysterious fellow named Tome Tome. Exactly who he is, he appears to have been or to be a Lebanese businessman. He claims to have been at one point a Senegalese ambassador, yet Senegal claims that he was not connected with that country in any way. So exactly who Tome Tome is and what he is remains to be determined past a point, but he was very much involved with handling Michael Jackson near the end of his life. And what is interesting is the fact, well, there are a lot of things that are interesting, but Michael Jackson was apparently in very bad health and had been for a long time, and those around him were aware that any attempts at getting him to go out and do a tour were very likely to result in his demise, because he just didn't have it left. Some who had investigated Michael Jackson claimed that he had a congenital disease, but in any event, he was in bad shape. And there's a very real question about how there were the extent to which people around him, shedding crocodile tears over his death, were really very pleased to see him die. Now, during the course of the loss, or during the course of the legal investigation into his alleged pedophilia, Michael Jackson claimed that he was being set up in order to basically get a whole lot of lucrative assets out of his grasp. And one of the things that he had to do in connection with his defense was to sell off part of the rights to the Beatles catalog, and that partnership became a joint Sony Michael Jackson venture. Sony previously had bought out Bertelsmann Music Group. So Sony is basically Sony BMG Music. BMG is the musical arm of the Bertelsmann firm. And then right after Michael Jackson's death, Colbert Kravis Roberts capitalized a new Bertelsmann Music venture, whereas Bertelsmann had pretty much gotten out of the music business. KKR capitalized a potentially very lucrative new Bertelsmann music business, and that involved licensing song rights. And one of the avenues of speculation was that one of the musical properties that they would attempt to get a hold of for licensing purposes was the Beatles catalog, now up for grabs up to a point after the death of Michael Jackson. So why would somebody want Michael Jackson out of the way? Money. And money is always a powerful political motivator. And another of the key people that was around Michael Jackson, and that concerned a fellow named Alvin Malnick. Alvin Malnick was an attorney of the Lansky milieu, dubbed by some to be the successor designate for the Lansky Syndicate. As we're going to see in a minute, Alvin Malnick had more connections than a switchboard, but it was Alvin Malnick whom Michael Jackson personally suspected of being the pivot point of an attempt to get a hold of his assets. But by way of taking a look at the elements around Michael Jackson. First of all, I've talked a great deal about Bertelsmann in the past. It appears to be connected with the Underground Reich. Reviewing now from For the Record 298, an article called Bertelsmann's Nazi Past by Hirsch Fischler and John Friedman in The Nation of December 28, 1998. When Bertelsmann applied after the war for a second publishing license, it was turned down by occupation authorities. Bertelsmann patriarch Heinrich Mohn had forgotten to mention that he had been a passive member of the SS as well as a supporter of the Hitler Youth and a member of the prestigious National Socialist Flying Corps, according to denazification files in the Central State Archive in Dusseldorf. And it should also be noted that Bertelsmann was the publisher for the SS in World War II. That was a long time ago, you say. Who cares if the old man, the patriarch of the company, was SS? Well, let's skip forward in time and bear in mind that Bertelsmann now is the largest publisher of English language books, since their Random House imprint is the largest single publisher of English language titles. But for those who think that Bertelsmann's Nazi past is a long way behind us and that it has no relevance, let's continue with another article by the same two authors and the same magazine. This is called Bertelsmann's Revisionist by Hirsch Fischler and John Friedman, again from The Nation, this from The Nation of November 8, 1999. And the key person we're talking about here is Dirk Bavendam. That is Bertelsmann's official historian of Bavendam, the authors write. His book, Roosevelt's Way to War, Roosevelt's Weg zum Krieg, was published in 1983. Rewriting history, he, Bavendam, stated that Roosevelt, not Hitler, had caused World War II. He also wrote that American Jews controlled most of the media, and he claimed they gave a false picture of Hitler. Did the book impress Heinrich's sons Reinhard Mohn, then the majority shareholder of Bertelsmann? The firm hired Bavendam as its house historian, and in 1984, he completed an historical study, 150 years of Bertelsmann, the founders and their time, with a foreword by Mohn. And basically, the official history exonerated Bertelsmann of collaboration in World War II, but in fact, it was the publisher for the SS, and Reinhard Mohn, SS man Heinrich Mohn's son, was instrumental in getting a fellow named Dieter Vogel appointed head of the giant Thyssen heavy industrial firm, the Thyssen firm at the epicenter of the Bormann Capital Network and the Underground Reich. And as I noted in past discussion of Bertelsmann, that is an indicator of just where the Mohn family fit in the firmament, so to speak, of Underground Reich power structure. Now, Alvin Malnick. Who was Alvin Malnick? And we're going to spend the rest of this broadcast talking about Alvin Malnick. Now, what we don't have time to cover in this side of the program is covered at length and in detail in For the Record 512 and the description for same. I think for the purposes of the present discussion, we might think of Alvin Malnick as sort of a lake. This is Lake Malnick. And what we're going to be talking about are the various interests that sort of have beach houses or boat houses on Lake Malnick. Because Alvin Malnick, again, he was the individual who was alleged by many, including Alvin Malnick, to be one of the executors of Michael Jackson's will, and also the individual whom Michael Jackson felt to be at the epicenter of a conspiracy to gain control of his wealth. Alvin Malnick had, as I like to say, more connections than a switchboard, and we're going to be taking a look at the many connections that he had with elements of the intelligence community, organized crime, the Saudi royal family. And so by way of understanding some of the interests that could be in play, in addition, of course, to Bertelsmann and the Underground Reich, we're going to take a look now at Alvin Malnick. Put this one away for future use. Now, again, one of the things that we've been talking about in connection with Michael Jackson is his disposition of his, is the disposition of his part ownership of the Beatles catalog. Beatles songs would be tremendously lucrative to be used for advertising purposes. Tuck this one away for the future and bear in mind KKR's capitalization of a new Bertelsmann music venture, which was launched within 2 weeks of Michael Jackson's death and which speculation had targeting the Beatles catalog previously co-owned by Sony and Michael Jackson. Bear in mind in connection with that that, well, just to sort of put this one away for future use. It'll be interesting to see German corporations and or Japanese corporations, but I'm particularly interested in German corporations, German automobile manufacturers in particular, utilizing Beatles songs as marketing devices. That would be very, very lucrative indeed. So tuck this one away in the future. It'll be interesting to see, in addition to obviously the tremendous profits to be derived in and of itself from marketing Michael Jackson or the Beatles catalog, keep your eyes peeled in the future for German corporations, automobile manufacturers in particular, using Beatles songs to sell product. And so as the world lays the king of pop, unquote, to rest and gets completely transfixed with the superficial hoo-ha, let's take a look at yet another of the elements around Michael Jackson when he bowed out. And there are some very chilling and thrilling people indeed in the life of Alvin Malnick. So again, think of Alvin Malnick as sort of a lake, and let's take a look at the many interests that have boathouses or beach houses on Lake Malnick. This, by the way, is taken from Barry and the Boys by Daniel Hopsicker, who wrote about Alvin Malnick at great length in a chapter called Alvin of Arabia, from which I took the title for the Record 512. Hopsicker writes in Barry and the Boys, Malnick was very close to Richard Benveniste, the late Barry Seal's lawyer and a member of the Keene Commission appointed to investigate 9/11. Richard Benveniste's close associate, Alvin Malnick, was Meyer Lansky's attorney. When Lansky died in 1983 at age 81, Reader's Digest named Malcolm Malnick his heir apparent, and the moniker stuck. Malnick has by now been called Meyer Lansky's heir apparent so often in print that it must feel like part of his job title, unquote. It was a known fact among the criminal underworld that dealing with Al Malnick was the same as dealing with Meyer Lansky, unquote, said Vincent Teresa, convicted criminal and government witness to investigators for the New Jersey Gambling Commission. Alvin Malnick's circle of acquaintances is perfectly illustrated in his role of director of Bank of World Commerce, a Bahamas-based institution involving some of the nation's top gangsters, the New Jersey Report said, quote, millions of dollars passed through the door and were reinvested in syndicate-controlled projects in the United States, unquote. But gangsters weren't all the bank was about. The Bank of World Commerce was the brainchild of CIA agent Colonel Paul Helliwell. Mob money flowed into its secret numbered accounts by the hundreds of millions, Lansky money, most of it, and then out again to the International Credit Bank of Switzerland before returning to the U.S. for reinvestment. Paul Helliwell, the CIA's paymaster at the Bay of Pigs, was also, as we were soon to learn, the true owner of Barry Seal's Learjet. Malnick had, in the early 1970s, invested in the Cricket Club, a Miami high-rise with 220 condos, and a frequent hangout of Barry Seal's while in Miami, where he also ate often at the Malnick-owned Forge restaurant. The club's developer, no doubt by coincidence, had been convicted with Teamster Jimmy Hoffa on fraud and conspiracy charges in 1964. Blackie had told us one of the Seal organization's investors was a central state Teamsters pension fund. But then, many of the Teamsters pension fund borrowers are associates of organized crime. $5.4 million, for example, was loaned to Alvin Malnick. Malnick was also tied to the world of the elder George Bush through, among others, the late Don Aronow. For more about Aronow's links to the world of the elder Bush, as well as Aronow's murder, see For the Record 516. Malnick had connections to George Bush Sr. as well. According to the book Blue Thunder, Bush even bought from Malnick associate Don Aronow one of his signature cigarette boats, the top choice of offshore smugglers. After Don Aronow was murdered, published accounts stated he had been a drug smuggler and money launderer linked to the Genovese Purple Gang of New York City within the framework of the Meyer Lansky organized crime syndicate. Aronow numbered among his friends public figures and celebrities like the head of the smugglers' airline, Eastern Chairman Frank Borman, savings and loan scandal poster boy Charles Keating, and Alvin Malnick, all exalted acquaintances suggestive of intelligence connections as well, unquote. Because Barry Seal's lawyer Richard Benveniste was such a close associate of Alvin Malnick's, we wanted to get an idea of what he'd been up to in the past several decades, and we didn't have to look very far in newspaper archives to find evidence of his enormous influence. More about Alvin Malnick, and again from Barry and the Boys by Daniel Hopsicker. The club's location inside the venerable Forge restaurant was meant to recall old Cuba. And in that, it succeeded beyond anyone's wildest dreams, said a Miami New Times profile of September 16, 1999. After all, the Forge is owned by Alvin Malnick, a man considered by federal law enforcement officials to be a major organized crime figure and, as former Miami Beach Rocky Pomerantz put it, Meyer Lansky's fair-haired boy. Alvin Malnick's involvement in loan sharking and, among other places, Tennessee, is covered here as well. Continuing with Hopsicker's text, Richard Benveniste's chum, Al Malnick, we discovered, is so powerful that he found a way to legalize loan sharking. He is Mr. Payday Loan. According to the Nashville, Tennessean of April 18, 1999, again quoting, the shadow of organized crime has descended on Tennessee's political landscape via campaign contributions from the operator of a string of Georgia-based auto title loan companies, the Tennessean has learned, unquote. The owners of Tennessee companies that loan money at almost 800% annual interest are kept secret from the public under the controversial payday loan law passed here earlier this year. In Florida, federal investigators have found organized crime figures infected in one such area Miami business, threatening to harm borrowers if they did not repay loans and interest. And the shadow of organized crime referred to is Alvin Malnick. Continuing, the shadow of organized crime referred to is Alvin Malnick, and making money off the poor, as anyone who watched The Soprano knows, is what mobsters do. According to a federal court indictment, members of the New York-based Gambino crime family found such an opportunity in Deerfield Beach, Florida. At Easy Check Cashing, a storefront business that extended large short-term loans similar to those made by payday loan companies in Tennessee, the Tennessean article said, adding, quote, the last thing needed by consumers who have exhausted all avenues to credit is to turn to businesses that offer loans at triple-digit interest, bankruptcy officials said. These are predators, stated one official. And continuing, the nine men, including John Gotti's successor, were charged with extortion for their easy loans, as well as conspiracy to kidnap, murder, and commit arson. Neither the public nor Tennessee law enforcement authorities have the right to learn who operates similar cash advance companies here, the Tennessean article continued, again quoting, by law, those records are kept secret at the State Department of Financial Institutions, unquote. I'm just shocked, said State Senator Roscoe Dixon, Democrat, of Memphis. And Hopsicker goes on to write, Senator Roscoe's being shocked reminds us of the bit in the movie Casablanca where Lieutenant Renault pockets his roulette winnings while simultaneously telling Bogey's Rick that he's shocked that gambling is taking place on the premises. Next, in order to understand some of the interests that have beach houses or boathouses on Lake Malnick, we're going to take a look at his wedding to a 25-year-old model. And one of the people who was present here was Generoso Pope, the son of Generoso Pope, the publisher of the National Enquirer. By the way, Generoso Pope was himself a former CIA psychological warfare officer, and his son was one of the people present at Alvin Malnick's wedding to a 25-year-old model. We're going to take a look at some more of Malnick's family values, and it's not just Meyer Lansky family, but the Saudi royal family in just a minute. Of Malnick's wedding, Hopsicker writes, several years ago, at the ripe age of 61, Malnick found it necessary to marry a young model 36 years his junior. Theirs became one of the lavish weddings that society columnists like the Miami Herald's Joan Fleischman loved to gush about. Wedding bells for Alvin Malnick, attorney, millionaire, restaurateur, long divorced, world traveler, wine connoisseur, car collector, fancier of Arabian horses, survivor of assorted federal mob investigations, a guy who really knows his way around. Malnick, 61, will marry Nancy Gresham, 25, a one-time model from Atlanta, in a black tie bash Saturday night at the private Malnick compound at Boca Raton, she wrote. And again quoting, the nuptials took place at the Malnick family ranch in Boca Raton, which was, Ms. Fleischman noted gleefully, more Hefner mansion than Little House on the Prairie. The 288 guests had cocktails, nibbled on salmon and beluga, and compared wedding notes in the sprawling patio area, which featured a meandering swimming pool, grill center, and kitchen, plus cute little fully stocked townhouses for overnight guests. The guest list reads like a who's who of a certain stratum of American life. Among the invitees were, but of course, Richard Benveniste, as well as F. Lee Bailey, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Deborah Winger, designer Nicole Miller, Manhattan real estate mogul Hank Sofer, L.A. restaurateur Nikki Blair, gangsta rap record producer Russell Simmons, Rebecca Gayhart, co-host of a Steven Spielberg TV show, Carol Connors, who wrote Gonna Fly Now, the theme song from Rocky, Darian Iacocca, wife number three of former Chrysler chairman Lee Iacocca, Paul Pope, whose dad, the late Generoso Pope, owned the National Enquirer, and mob associate and casino czar Clifford Perlman. By the way, I want to add here, the fact that somebody was present at Malnick's wedding does not necessarily mean there's anything sinister about them. For example, I would not worry about Deborah Winger a whole lot. But again, it's worth taking a note, of just who this guy was involved with. Continuing, the list goes on. Worth noting was actor Gianni Russo, who, in a bit of unintended irony which the Miami Herald reported straight-faced, had played Al Pacino's bookie brother-in-law Carlo Rizzi in The Godfather. Alvin the groom presented his bride with that ultimate wedding gift of choice we learned, the 50-carat emerald and diamond necklace. Then we were surprised to read that there had been a table at the Malnick's nuptials reserved for Saudi Arabian sheiks, that the St. Louis-born Alvin, who's Jewish, had a son who had changed his name to Sharif and married a woman from the Saudi royal family, not previously known, by us at least, as being cozy with Jewish mobsters. And still more about Alvin Malnick's son marrying into the Saudi royal family. So again, among the interests with the boathouse on Lake Malnick, the Saudi royal family. Continuing with Hopsicker's text. They met 2 years ago at a party and fell in love, said Sharif Malnick, the groom's son and best man. She is very beautiful. The story, as we pieced it together, was incredible. Incredible, but true. Malnick had befriended a Saudi family in the early 80s, the Al-Fassi Tariq family from Saudi Arabia, various newspaper accounts reported. This set off a dim memory for us, since this family, the Al-Fassis, had scandalized the blasé Beverly Hills while we lived nearby. After arriving with an entourage of bodyguards, cooks, and other servants, the family had purchased a highly visible $2.4 million estate right on Sunset Boulevard in Beverly Hills. They then began renovating, placing anatomically correct flesh-colored Roman statues on the walls, complete with painted-on black pubic hair. Gawkers were lining up all day. The house quickly became the talk of the town. Some in the clannish enclave were clearly not amused. The mansion was, in short order, burned down by arsonists. For those of us living in L.A. at the time, as far as we knew, that had been the end of the Saudi scandal. But there was, we now learned with mounting excitement, much more to the story. When the Al-Fassis left L.A., they had continued roaming the world, spending spectacular sums of brother-in-law Saudi royal prince Turkey's money on lavish parties, chartered jets, hotel suites by the floor, automobiles by the fleet, clothing by the rack, and jewelry by the tray. They soon joined the prince in Europe, where they became involved with the increasingly ubiquitous Alvin Malnick, settling down for 6 months at the Intercontinental Hotel in Geneva, where the prince distributed bundles of cash to his insatiable entourage. Malnick and Prince Turki, the son of the founder of modern Saudi Arabia, King Abdulaziz, had grown chummy. As a friend of the prince told People magazine, quote, the prince trusted and respected Al so much that slowly the power shifted to Al. It was Al who controlled the cash, who told the prince to put money in this business or that business, unquote. Then, as if the idea of a Jewish mobster from Miami controlling the cash of a Saudi royal prince isn't bizarre enough, Malnick's son Mark, a 23-year-old student, fell in love with Sheikh Al-Fassi's sister. It hardly mattered that a Mrs. Mark Malnick waited for him in Florida, sniffed People magazine. It certainly didn't matter to the Alfossis, whose romantic permutations were already complicated enough to befuddle even the most attentive scorekeeper. So Alvin Malnick's son Mark, a young Jewish married man, was now in full pursuit of Saudi Prince Turki's sister-in-law. In his new role as advisor and confidant to the prince, Malnick devised a solution. Al came up with a good idea, said People Mag's anonymous source. Come to the U.S., he said. I'll take care of everything, unquote. Once in Miami, Malnick soon assumed control over the prince's schedule and contacts. Prince Turki created a two-story apartment in Malnick's North Miami condominium, the Cricket Club, directly below Alvin's penthouse. Soon, the entourage was engaging the protective services of half the off-duty police force of nearby Hollywood, Florida. Under Malnick's tutelage, Prince Turki paid $3 million in cash for the Wordsworth Estate, one of the graceful waterfront homes on Florida's Gold Coast. The Alfassi clan also paid an inflated $1.5 million for two waterfront homes between Miami Beach and the city of Miami. Then, showing that their taste had not improved since leaving Beverly Hills, they demolished the houses to erect what people called the Xanadu of Kitsch, and which one of the contractors described as, quote, the biggest hunk of crap ever built on the face of the earth, unquote. In all, the Fossies would pay $17 million for houses and other properties, and the Malnicks, father and son, were now beginning to study Arabic. Young Mark took to carrying the Quran around with him. Then a devastating blow struck the Saudi prince and his entourage. Miami police, acting on a complaint that servants were being held as slaves, stormed the Cricket Club sanctuary. But the cops never got a chance to carry out their search. One of the princesses began shouting very unroyal obscenities at them, biting a policewoman deep enough to leave tooth marks for days. Family bodyguards quickly came to her rescue. A standoff ensued, and startled police were obliged to retreat. As suits and countersuits began to fly between Saudi Prince Turki and outraged Florida state attorney, the U.S. State Department rushed in a former ambassador to Saudi Arabia to serve as intermediary. He secured a face-saving diplomatic immunity for the prince. Then the prince's brother-in-law, Alfossi, offered to sell a stolen $1.2 million emerald and diamond ring to an undercover FBI agent. He did not have diplomatic immunity, and was charged with interstate and international transportation of stolen goods as a felony punishable by a maximum of 10 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. And fortunately, however, he did have a good attorney. The lucky sheik had at last a well-connected lawyer, Richard Benveniste. When all this bad news reached the ear of the Saudi king back in Riyadh, he ordered the prince to end his long exile and return home. Once at home, the prince's family circle broadened to include their friends formerly named Malnick. Both father and son were said to have taken Arabic names and converted to Islam. What pertinence does the story of attorney Alvin Malnick, heir to Meyer Lansky, converting to Islam and living in Saudi Arabia as an advisor to a member of the Saudi royal family, have to do with the saga of Barry and the Boys? In 1982, Barry Seal began flying weapons to the Contras from Mena, Arkansas, which had been paid for with Saudi royal family money. So is Malnick and his son now, have they converted to Islam? Who knows? A lot of interesting people, though, waiting upon the shores of Lake Malnick, and Alvin Malnick at the epicenter of the struggle around Michael Jackson's estate. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 695, Dancing Machine, Reflections on the Life and Death of Michael Jackson. This program has been recorded on November 1st of 2009. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.